Please chant home with me. Chant Om, it goes from the back of the throat, then to the middle of the mouth, and then out through the lips. So you feel the vibration first, clear back as far as you can sense into your throat, your mouth area, and then the vibration slowly comes forward in the mouth. You feel it in the center region of the mouth, and then finally your lips come together in a vibration. So it comes out, oh. Let's try it all together, starting from the back of the throat, middle mouth, all the way to the lips. Feel the vibration moving all the way through. Let's try it one more time. Such a lovely vibration. You can chant that any time, any place. I like to read from the Bhagavad Gita, God Talks with Arjuna, Royal Science of God Realization by Paramahansa Yogananda. This is Chapter 9, The Supreme Science of Knowing God. And the Gita verses 1 and 2. The Exalted Lord said to Arjuna, I gave this imperishable yoga to Vishvavat, the sun god. Vishvavat passed on the knowledge to Manu, the Hindu lawgiver. Manu told it to Ikshvaka, founder of the solar dynasty of Kshatriyas, handed down in this way in orderly succession. The Raja Rishis, the royal Rishis, knew it. But, O searcher of foes, Arjuna, by the long passage of time, this yoga was lost sight of on earth. This is Yogananda's commentary. Spirit, cosmic consciousness, here symbolized as Krishna, gave the indestructible Raja Yoga science, the technique of uniting soul and spirit to the ancient illuminato Vishvavan, the deity of the sun. It is manifested also in man as the microcosmic sun or light of spiritual eye, the epitome of all life and consciousness, in the incarnate being. Vishvavat imparted the sacred yoga to the exponent of Dharma, Manu, symbolizing Manas, the mind, the instrument from which sentient human consciousness derives. Manu bestowed it on the founder of the solar dynasty of Kshatriya, Ikshvaku, symbolic of the intuitive astral eye of life and consciousness in man. In this orderly succession, this yoga was then bequeathed to the royal sages, symbolizing the descent of life and consciousness into the senses, giving man sensory perception and interaction with the material world. Thereafter, when the cycles of the world entered the Dark Ages, knowledge of this divine science deteriorated and was lost. Symbolically, throughout many incarnations, the senses are engrossed in and identified with matter, and man thus loses the knowledge and ability of reuniting his soul with spirit. These two verses thus proclaim the historical antiquity of Raja or Royal Yoga, the eternal, immutable science of uniting soul and spirit. At the same time, understood esoterically, they give a concise description of that science, the steps by which the soul descends from cosmic consciousness to the mortal state of identification with the human body, and the route it must take to reascend to its source, the all-blissful, eternal spirit. In the beginning of creation and the advent of man, the infinite impregnated his intelligent, creative cosmic energy, Mahaprakriti, or Holy Ghost, with not only the power of repulsion, the individualizing of cosmic consciousness into souls and a universe of matter, but also with the power of recalling souls from their prodigal wanderings in matter back to the unity with spirit. All things come from, are made of, sustained by, and ultimately resolve into this intelligent cosmic energy, and therefore into spirit. Ascension follows in reverse the exact course of descension. In man, that course is the inner highway to the infinite, the only route to divine union for followers of all religions in all ages. By whatever bypath or beliefs or practices or a being reaches that singular highway, the final ascension from body consciousness to spirit is the same for everyone. The final ascension from body consciousness to spirit is the same for everyone. The withdrawal of life and consciousness from the senses upward through the gates of light into the subtle cerebrospinal centers, dissolving the consciousness of matter into life force, life force into mind, mind into soul, and soul into spirit. The method of ascension is Raja Yoga. The eternal science has been integral in the creation from its inception. There are many wonderful truths in this writing. And here Yogananda gives an example of how scriptures have multiple meanings, that every scripture has a physical meaning, an astral meaning, a causal meaning, and a spiritual meaning. Because within everyone, all of these bodies exist. We are made in the likeness and in the image of God. These are no small words. Likeness means the spirit. We have that same perfect, pure consciousness residing within us. For most people, it is a latent consciousness. It is not fully known. And yet, it is the very source of our beings, of our intelligence, and of our feeling. We also are made in the form of God, the image of God. And that is that we have taken on a mental body, an astral or electrical body, and a physical body. That means that when we are speaking of these truths of ascending back into our true spiritual nature, originally that spiritual nature projected itself as mental, and then astral, electrical, and finally physical. When we turn our attention to go back into spiritual consciousness and reunite ourselves, the soul, with the Spirit of God, then we reverse that process. We withdraw the life force into the spine. We lift it up in consciousness through meditation and deepened prayer. And at first, we fight with the body. The body is restless. All the life energy continues to filter into the body. And so we get aches, we get pains, we get restlessness in the body, we want to move, we want to shift. If we are successful in transcending that and withdrawing the life force from the outward extremities of the body, then we come into the energy body or the astral body. And there we feel the energy, and for most people living in this world, it's made up either of tamasic energy or rajasic energy. Tamasic energy is when you feel that lethargy. You feel like you have no life force at all. You don't feel like doing anything. You don't feel like accomplishing anything. There is no enthusiasm for life whatsoever. And this is the darkness of the tamasic, and this is the lowest stage of consciousness. The other stage is rajasic. That is the activating form. It is the restlessness, always on the move, always needs to be doing something. What's next? What's bigger? What's better? The soul is restless for experience. And whether it is purely through the senses, and wanting more sensual, sensory kind of experiences, or whether it is for power, or for prestige, or whatever the outward focus, that rajasic energy pushes us forward, and it keeps us restless. There is a third form of energy, and it is less frequent in this life, and that is sattvic energy. That is that peaceful, pure, uplifting consciousness. It is the state that we feel when we are meditating, and we feel ourselves completely still, completely at peace with ourselves and with the world. And this is a beautiful and a wonderful state of consciousness. It is what aspirants are looking for, wanting more of in their life. When the soul becomes tired of being tossed between the tamasic and the rajasic and yearns with everything in itself to have that sattvic state, then it begins to turn its mind within. And through that inward focus, it begins to feel the calmness, the soothing state of uplifted consciousness. But there is something that is beyond that even. And when we get into higher and uplifted states of consciousness, we become completely still. We go beyond all form. We go beyond thought of trying to gain something or wanting to gain something. We feel like that what we really want is that eternal spirit that resides in us. It is a state beyond the sattvic state. Because from that supreme state, we look out upon this world and we see that everything is a vacillation between the good and the bad, the high and the low, the up and the down. that there is a restless tide, but there is a monotony to that restless tide. Man is born into a body. He grows into childhood, then into adulthood, looks for a mate, forms a family, and then the family eventually leaves the home, and the body begins to grow older until it finds some reason for the soul to depart from the body. In my own experiences, I have remembered many different lifetimes that I have lived. And in truth, there is a kind of monotony that comes to the whole process after a while. Things have a repetition to them. We always think that we're going to turn a corner, that we'll just get our life arranged in just the right way. And when it's arranged just in the right way, then we'll be happy. Then we'll find the key to everything that is satisfying and fulfilling. The truth is, that never comes in a worldly sense, even though that's where we put our focus. Now, it doesn't mean that it's not good to set out with goals, to try to accomplish things in this life. But when we put all of our eggs in one basket, so to speak, into this material body and into this worldly sense of things, we have really put all of our eggs into a sinking ship. Because eventually this ship, the body, will sink. It will submerge back into the waters of consciousness, and we will leave it. And it will turn back into dust once again. That divine spark, that soul that is within us, will depart, and we will know with greater certainty, with greater understanding, that our life is not dependent upon this body. That life is more than the bread that we eat. It is more than the liquids we drink. It is more than the sensory experiences we have. And that hidden within that divine spark is the fulfillment that we have been searching for all of this time. This is the message of all the great religions. It is the message of all the great spiritual masters. But most of us are made up of mixed nature. We have that tamasic, we have that rajasic, and we have a little bit of sattvic thrown in. And for our own nature as spiritual aspirants, we are seeking to refine this body and this mind and this electrical body, this astral body, so that it may experience the spiritual current more consciously, more fully, more constantly. This is our spiritual path. It is to withdraw the life force from this body, center it into the spine. Now, some spiritual aspirants do that in an unconscious way, through prayer, through deepened meditation, perhaps through taking long walks in the woods, sitting beside a quiet stream. The soul turns inside, turns its attention within, and begins to feel itself in touch with something greater than itself. Fascinated with this experience, the soul continues in an unconscious way, without knowing the way, perhaps, in a methodical form, but rather just intuitively feeling its way along. I think in the beginning, for the rishis, for those souls who in ancient times discovered this path, it must have come about in such a way that there is an unconscious reaching out, a turning within, and the more deeply the mind got turned within, the more this inward experience began to open up, and along with it, the revelatory truths, those eternal truths, that we are not a body, but we are a soul, began to reveal themselves. By going through these experiences in the body, in the mind, and in the soul, eventually methods were developed for turning the mind within, that there needed to be shortcuts for those souls who wanted to find out the truth. It would be no different than any science or mathematics. If a student were left to their own to figure out how to get the rules of addition and subtraction, multiplication and division, the very bright ones would be able to do it. And eventually they might stumble upon algebra and geometry. But it's not necessary for students today to go through that trial of hit and miss method. Rather, students can be taught all of those basic mathematical skills so that they can turn their minds upon more refined ones. And the same is true in every field of science, that the basic assumptions, the basic truths that are already understood, can be taught. And the new frontiers, those things that are not yet understood, can be focused on by the best and the brightest. So with our spiritual science, there are fundamentals that have been discovered. There are truths that are known. And the methods that are given to us are given as shortcuts, are given as methods by which we might make advancement more quickly than if we just had to do the hunt and peck method. It is up to us whether we choose to decide to use those methods or not. Lahari Mahasya asked Babaji, please let me initiate those who are not able to give themselves fully to this path as sannyasis, as those who renounce everything in life, those who are householders, those who are seeking for the truth. Let me give these methods, let me give these ways, so that they may make spiritual progress. They may do it imperfectly. They may not be able to make the full effort, but every effort made is some advancement for the soul. So please let me teach those who sincerely wish to make advancement upon this path. And Babaji, in his graciousness, gave that permission. But it should not be assumed, because that permission is given, that this path, that these meditation methods that were taught, should be taken for granted, or that they are something that can be just tried for a while and easily tossed aside. They are gems. They are jewels. They are the refinement of Babaji's own mind and his own experiences, and of many generations of yogis before him. They are of the very highest nature. And when we are given those tools, there is a certain responsibility that goes along with them. A responsibility to ourselves, to God within us, to practice those methods, to put our full effort into them. It's not easy, I know. I think that for many of us, it is easier when we can turn our full attention to doing just one thing at a time. And it is more difficult when we have several things that we have to do, And we have to turn our attention from one thing to the other. We have a living to make. We have families to take care of. We have so many things in our life that calls to us. And we are making a commitment to this spiritual path. And so many times it is easy to let the spiritual commitment come last. Everything else seems to call us first. And then, of course, there's time to have some fun and some play, maybe watch some television or a movie. And the list goes on and on of the diversions that keep us from turning our full attention to the divine. It is not until we have fully incorporated that divine consciousness into our own consciousness that we can let go of any of our spiritual practice whatsoever. Until then, we must make every effort to employ these methods to do our very level best at setting aside the time and making the commitment. If we do not do it, it is of no benefit to ourselves, to our soul's progress. One time I was thinking about waking up from a lifetime that I had had, and at the end of that lifetime, I was thinking to myself, I blew it again. I come into that lifetime with every intention of making spiritual progress, but it seemed like everything else reached out for my attention. My old habits guided me along a path that made me fall asleep to my spiritual dimension once again. And I thought, one more lifetime spiritually wasted. How many lifetimes have we woken up to that exact same feeling? It is like waking up in your own life after some hours or days, weeks or months, and saying, with all the best intentions, I've not achieved that goal that I set out to achieve. And how much more important is our spiritual goal? There is a song that was written for the movie Brother, Son, Sister, Moon about St. Francis of Assisi. And the song's lyrics went something like this: do few things, but do them well. Sometimes it's difficult to simplify our life. It seems like we rush after everything to make our lives more complicated. I felt that in my own life at one time. I was raising a family. I had a full-time job. I was doing a lot of volunteer mediation, and later on I started a mediation business, working 60, 70, 80 hours a week was not uncommon, and having a family besides. And if every moment wasn't filled, it seemed like that I worked to fill it in. If there was some gap that came along, I did something to fill in that gap. And I finally had to take myself by the hand and just ask myself what I was doing. It seemed as if I stopped, if I came to a resting point, that everything would fall collapsing right on top of me. And it is the soul's unconscious fear of what will happen if this whole world comes to a stop, our whole outer world. Well, who would I be? Who am I? Do I want that to happen? And I think in most of us there's an unconscious fear of slowing down, of turning the mind within. We feel like if we do that, our whole world might collapse. It can be so extreme that we can feel like we would die. And so the fear starts running inside of us. We try to meditate, but the fear takes us over, and it moves us into the body, back into the world, back into activity once again. And it is destructive to finding that spiritual peace that dwells within us. All of us are encountering life in a very similar way. And that is, we come with some skills, we come with intelligence, hopefully. We come with a desire, or many desires, more likely. And we are making our life in this world, but one thing we also all share, everyone sitting in this room, and that is an innate desire for something more, something greater, something higher, something more beautiful. We may not have a name for it. We may not know exactly what that experience is, but there's something inside of us that drives us forward. That unnamed something is the most powerful thing operating in our life. Sometimes it feels very weak and overwhelmed by all the outer experiences. But I say it is more powerful because if you will notice that no matter how far you turn away from it, how much you try to run away from it, it follows you. You can't leave it behind. It will not be left behind. And it will follow you beyond this lifetime. It is that inward part of your soul that is ever calling to you, ever desiring its own awakening. All life is in that evolutionary pattern of transformation, of upliftment. Most life is doing it unconsciously. I have written to you about some of the strange and interesting experiences that I've been having since the first of the year. And it's been most fascinating. You know, I've been the observer and the learner and the one who has been going through many of these things within my own being, absolutely stupefied by many of the events that have occurred. From the very beginning of the year, I felt a tremendous weight on me. It's difficult to move this body, but it was more than just a physical kind of a feeling of weight. It was happening on the energy level and on the mental level as well. It felt to me as if the whole earth was pressing down. It may seem extreme, but that's the feeling that it was there. After some time, after some weeks of having this tremendous pressure on me, the war in Iraq began. And as that war raged on, I felt the effects in my own body. It's hard to describe. Mother used to talk about things being given to her, and I could hear it, I could listen to it, I knew it with one part of my mind, but it was difficult for me to completely know it, completely absorb it, because I hadn't had that experience. It seems that in following her and in following this path, part of what has been given to me is to replicate many of the things that she went through as well. And some of that is taking on the effects of things that go on in the lives of others. And it's a fascinating thing to observe. It's not anything that I do of myself. It's something that I observe. And I know the truth of it because the truth penetrates through so many layers. Most of us are used to knowing things with the mind. Well, this is what I think. This is what I believe. And that's fine. That's where we have to start out at. But I know that all of you have had some experience with getting a more profound way of knowing. something that penetrates into the very cells of your being. It may be just an occasional experience here or there. But as we grow in this consciousness, that penetration into the cells, the truth, resounds through our entire being. And it strikes us so forcefully and with such truth that we absolutely know it. And then we see it demonstrated in life. We see the things that are talked about as coming true. We see the things that we know from within corresponding to the people and situations outside of us. God will give me something, some malady in this body or something to deal with. And somebody's name will come to me. Somebody's face will come to my internal vision. And I'll just feel that whatever it is that I'm experiencing is somehow connected with them. And sure enough, oftentimes that individual will give me a call and saying they're having some difficulty with exactly what I've been experiencing. I may have told you the story. It comes up as an example in my mind at this time that somebody was having a lot of kundalini heat. And so I was too having a lot of kundalini heat running throughout my body and through my mind. And it was quite intense for me one time. And I was driving down the highway. I had a cell phone with me and I picked it up and I called that person. And they said, "Oh, I'm having so much heat." And I said, "Do you have an ice pack on?" "No, I don't have an ice pack on. I'm really quite enjoying it." I said, "Well, I'm not enjoying it so much. Will you put an ice pack on?" And they said, "Yes, I will." And within 10 or 15 minutes, the heat in me started to subside and go all the way down. And they called back and they said, "All right, I put the ice pack on and all the heat's gone now." So that's how it goes in this body. Well, with this war going on, I felt the pounding of the bombs going on in the earth as if it was pounding right in my own body. I felt at times that the flesh was being ripped off my own body. It sounds gruesome, but that's how it felt to me. Now, through all of these experiences and more, I never felt cut off from God. I never felt a disconnect in that way. In fact, I felt that these experiences themselves were coming from this divine consciousness, and it was a part of the purification that was going on in this world. Toward the end of these experiences, Carla came into the room where I had been at, and she says, "It smells like burning ashes in here." And she came up, and she got closer to me, and she said, "You smell like burning ashes to me." The whole room was filled with that aroma. This war was raging right inside my own being. And finally, there was some break, some shift that I felt inside. And it wasn't immediately, but I knew that the experiences would start to pass from me. That was very interesting because all last year, I was on, due to God's prompting, I was on some exercise regimen. I was walking every day. I was lifting some light weights. And I was in very good physical condition by the time the first of the year came around. And I needed it, I can tell you, in order to get through these experiences. Now, I don't tell you these things to say anything about myself in that way, only that this is a tremendously interesting, powerful experience that we all share on some level, this world consciousness. The world is made up of individuals. Each individual brings their own part. Some of it good, some of it not so good. All of it working out the consciousness of the collective. Through that collective consciousness, we have formed this earth. We have formed the beauty of it and also the difficulties residing within it. As a result of that collective consciousness, we have weather patterns. This earth itself breathes through its weather patterns. It moves sometimes through earthquakes and other things that we consider catastrophic. It has all the motions of life within it. And who we are, what we project, what we collectively do, has an impact on this great being of the earth. And so the world that we make here is a result of what we have all collectively done. And you can take that as a compliment or an insult, depending on what aspect of the earth you might be looking at. But it is a fascinating thing to see the movements of this collective consciousness and the direction that it's moving into. Sometimes we think this world is getting worse. Sometimes we think that the virtues of mankind have fallen completely off the table and are not even in sight. Other times we see tremendous acts of courage and integrity. And it is true that this world is of a very mixed nature. It is also true, as Sri Yukteswar pointed out, that we are headed for a more enlightened age. But we are coming through a very difficult time of darkness. And that time of darkness holds on. The tension created between the expansive spirit that is progressing through human consciousness and the old contractive habit patterns create these lines of clashing forces. Now the very same thing happens within us. Consciousness is looking to expand, is purifying the body, the mind, the emotions. But the ego is constrictive, wants to preserve what it's had from the past. It's instinctive to it. And so this clashing of forces happens right within our own being. The war happens right within us. And so whether the war is happening on a collective basis or happening in the internal sense, it is a great reality within us, and we must understand its true nature. We must understand that this is consciousness looking to purify itself, to expand, and to spiritualize the entire being, whether it's the individual being or whether it's the collective being of man. When we see the world this way, and when we see our own individual experience this way, when we see the experience of those that we meet as a product of those clashing forces, it gives us a new and different way to look at this world. It's not just about that personality of that individual who's irritating to you, or one who's inspiring to you. It is about that force within that that light within that person that is looking to expand, uplift, and purify. The same force that is working within you. And if it's uneven, if sometimes it doesn't look so good, whether within you or within them, you can have that greater understanding, that greater appreciation that this is the working out of yours and their consciousness. And this changes your entire view of the world. You see us all moving toward that perfection, toward that purity, toward that light. And it helps to spiritualize your vision of this world. You don't personalize it so much. You don't confine individuals to being just a certain pattern. Oh, that's that person. That's how they act. They always act that way. You've just cut them off from their spiritual source. That individual is the consciousness working itself out, and it's the light within that one who's trying to grow. If you refuse to lose sight of the light within that one, you add strength and power to the light. If you only look at the difficulty that one is going through, only the bad habit patterns, then you add power to those bad habit patterns. So it's very important to see the light within each one, to see the beauty within each one, to see consciousness working itself out. And sometimes, you know, somebody who's very, very bad, when they turn it around, they become very, very good. When you look at the lives of so many of the saints, they started out very, very bad. But when they turned it around, they took all that dynamic energy that they've been using for wrong and turned it in to using it to find God. And what a powerful engine they became. So you never know when somebody's right on the cusp. They may be acting in a very bad way, but they're right on the cusp. And they're ready to turn it around. They're ready to focus it on God. But they haven't quite gotten there yet. And you can add to it. You can add to their journey. You can add to the light within them by recognizing this is consciousness working itself out, no matter what it looks like from the outside. Let me stop there and see if there are any thoughts or observations or questions about anything I've spoken about or your own sadhana. Each one of us comes to fulfill a certain duty, a certain work in this life. And it's been the divine will that this form takes on a certain amount of that. One kind of analogy came to me one time is I used to be in the Boy Scouts. And sometimes, inevitably, some of the younger ones, they'd have bad-fitting shoes on a hike, and their pack didn't fit so well, and they usually brought cans of beans and things like that before you figured out they were way too heavy to carry for a hike. And they'd just be struggling, and their feet would be hurting, and about that time, a scoutmaster might come along and just say, well, why don't you just let me take your pack for a while? You just walk on down the trail and do the best that you can. So he would lift the pack off and let the tenderfoot continue on their way. And gradually, as they got better at it, they learned what to carry, what not to carry. They got stronger, more adapted to the trail and to the walking, and they could carry more of their own pack. And so in that way, a kind of spiritual work is to help lift the burden. Now, sometimes you take a portion. Sometimes you take it all, depending on the individual and what they're needing at that time. Sometimes an individual soul needs just a little help to get it all over the top of the hill. Sometimes they need more help. Sometimes this world as a whole needs an extra boost. And so some souls that have been designated by the divine are on this earth that can help in that kind of a way. Does that make sense? Anything in particular?
Well, I guess it's just sort of like the one that we just kind of been through. I mean, is the war, can you sort of see it as it's a war with ourselves against the past of, you know, the negative and the, and then the higher, you know, so the forces that are fighting the lower
nature
versus higher nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
Kind of like the war.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That there are, in the outer sense, there are these karmic forces that are regressive in nature, and that there are others that are progressive in nature. And even as sometimes in outward political and military kind of campaigns, people have difficulty identifying what's of the good, what is of the light, and what is of the dark, what is regressive. So within ourselves, we don't always know what represents my growth. Sometimes I hear people say, well, that just, I need to do this just because I need to do it, because I need to be free. And what it is it's a feeling of a need for a license to do something, anything. And it's oftentimes a movement toward the senses, getting more involved with the senses. So that discernment, knowing what uplifts, what purifies, what takes us higher, and what takes us away from the light, further from the light, is of the most urgent kind of need for us to know and to be able to identify that. We use the mind at first. That's where Moses came and gave the Ten Commandments. Yeah, Patanjali gave the yamas and the niyamas, the do's and the don'ts. And these are the mind's way of trying to grasp with what's the right direction. How do I do what's good, what's right, what helps me to progress? And so when we don't know anything else, the mind can at least use these do's and don'ts. Very basic to life. We all know what they are. As the consciousness gets more refined, it begins to get a greater intuitive perception of what takes it closer to the light. Now, how do we know whether that's true or not? Is it a true intuition or not? The intuition will always make us feel in a more purified, uplifted state. Now, that doesn't mean right from the very beginning we feel the bliss of God. Sometimes, many times, what it asks us to do is very difficult. There's a saying, when faced with a decision, do the harder. And that's usually the right thing to do. It's looking for what is right. If we are to lead lives with complete and total honesty, and we find a $10 bill lying on the ground, what do we do with it? If we find a $1,000 bill laying on the ground, what do we do with that? You see, and what is difficult for one person would not be hard at all for another person, but that other person has some other area where they'll be tempted. So temptation comes, and this is part of the battlefield. And we have to wage that war with as much integrity, with as much truthfulness, as we can muster within ourselves, because it's easy to lie to ourselves. It's easy to say, I really think this $1,000 bill, I can do a lot of good with that, you know. I'm going to do some good things with that. And so I'm just going to take it and run with it. And so it's easy for the mind to talk itself into these kind of things. But inevitably, what happens is, maybe not all at once, but eventually, we start to feel a degradation of the consciousness. We don't feel right about ourselves. We don't feel right with God. We don't feel that purity in the same way any longer. And those kinds of feelings are good indications we've taken the wrong path. One of the things that I've done, and it's been helpful, is to just visualize all the spiritual masters around you. How would they feel about your decision? A lot of times that's very clarifying. Very clear, no, I wouldn't want to do it in the light of day. And so no, that's not something that I'm going to do. One of my favorite definitions of character is what you do when you think no one is watching. But as the man who was the disciple and the master said to all his disciples, each one of you have a chicken, go and kill it where no one can see. And they all went out, and most of them returned in very short order, kind of feeling rather smug about themselves. And each one reported, yes, they had successfully killed the chicken where no one could see. So one disciple was gone for 3, 4, or 5 days. He came back. He hadn't slept. He'd been going around from place to place to place. And the master said, what? The chicken's still alive. He says, why didn't you kill it? He says, well, wherever I went, the chicken could see. So I couldn't kill it. So we're always being watched. And not by some vengeful God who's handing out judgments. God exists inside of here, and we know. We know what's right. We know what's uplifting. We know what's purifying, really. We can have states of confusion, true enough. We need to learn from those times if we blow it, if we do something and it doesn't work out. That's part of the path. It's not an excuse, but it's part of the path. And we get back on the path and we keep going. But if we are leading our lives in the way that we should, we will feel right about it. At least we will feel, there's no other thing that I could do. I have to go in this direction. And I don't have confirmation right away, but I also feel with everything in my being, I have to do this. And that is where we live for
from day to day. That's our battlefield. It's not different from our lives. It's not, leading a spiritual life is not meditating for 20 minutes in the morning at night and forgetting about it the rest of the time. We have to carry it into our life so that it becomes impregnated in everything that we do. Just that alone, what I've just described as a full-time occupation, I mean, that's it. That's our sadhana. There are other things, of course, but that is so basic and fundamental. The other can be just taking an attitude of service. It's so easy to serve those who love us and like us. But let somebody speak badly about us, it's really tough to serve them. Or somebody who doesn't treat us very nicely or a little bit rudely, and we want to do exactly the same thing back to them and maybe a couple of kicks besides. So to take that attitude of service and incorporate it into everything that we do takes a lot of self-discipline, takes a lot of awareness. And that too is a great spiritual sadhana. Those are the battlefields that exist inside of us. And we don't have to go far to find them. Just have to open our eyes, enter into the world, and we're there. That's the good news. It's, I came out of a spiritual store one time and I said, you know, it costs a lot of money to be spiritual. After I saw all those things for sale. It's like, the person is going to go exercise and they think, well, I need, the latest style suit and I need the right shoes and I need all the equipment. And really all you need to do is walk outside of your door and start walking. And it's right there. It's available. It's easy from that standpoint. We can get sidetracked with all the other issues about leading a spiritual life. It is our life. Our life is our sadhana. It's our path. It's right where we find ourselves. See, when you feel yourself vibrating with the peace and the spirit and the love of God, and it moves through your entire being no matter what you're doing, eating, sleeping, working, playing, whatever you're doing, and you feel that consciousness constantly with you, then you have entered into that kingdom that Jesus spoke of, that Buddha spoke of, that Krishna spoke of, that all the great masters have spoken of. And it is inherently yours. And that's the greatest measure, as Sri Yukteswar said, ever expanding, ever new joy is your measurement of realization. Other observations, thoughts, questions? Don't be discouraged. Lari Mahasi used to say, working, working, working. One day the goal. Just keep working. Let's have our closing prayer. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging through every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Stay about the light with